business of culture, the culture of business, media and technology, markets, policy, creatives. Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad.
A lot of the time, ideas were evaluated by who brought them in. And if somebody were in favor in the organization, they could have the worst idea since New Coke, and it would still get greenlit. I mentioned in the piece Theo Balcom, who had this idea for a daily news podcast for a while, and I remember her going through that, the process for getting your idea, even if it's the best idea in the world, through that bureaucracy is just, it's been discouraging to a lot of people beyond me.
Alicia Montgomery, Slate's head of audio, on the simultaneous convergence and bifurcation of public and private media amid a trying time for her longtime home, NPR. Stay with us. Full Disclosure Podcast to NPR, Spotify, and of course, Apple Podcasts. The link is fulldradio.com. You can follow on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at handle fulldradio. And a shout out to our listeners on WVTF Radio IQ, Virginia's NPR news station. You can DM me to carry Full Disclosure on your air. Joining me from the nation's capital, it's a joy to have her on finally, Alicia Montgomery, head of audio for Slate. Alicia's a veteran of NPR, where we first crossed paths. We worked together, I believe, on the show Tell Me More, which saw its last episode, I think, in 2013, the late, great...
2014.
2014. I miss it, and I miss you. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay. And I got to say that you've been top of mind because as a lot of people have been contacting you about the essay that you had that came out last week as NPR, the mothership as it's called, and Nippers are having another round of troubles. And you penned this essay for Slate, the real story behind NPR's current problems. Yes, the broadcaster is a mess, but quote, wokeness isn't the issue. You were, of course, responding to the recently resigned or defenestrated business editor Uri Berliner, who I did work with. He published a commentary that pretty much blamed NPR's woes on wokeness and democratic partisanship. And you went far deeper and said that there are cultural impediments and just an inability to adapt. And I wanted to talk to you about it because there's so much here to unpack. Take me back to your own original experience with NPR, Alicia. You joined, I believe it was in the late 90s?
I came on board in 1997 as an admin assistant, administrative assistant for the audience research department. Way, way back then, and this story has stuck with me over the years, you know, my first big assignment was helping to package and send out this report, this beautiful report about potential African-American listeners. And it was just full of data about where potential Black listeners shopped, where they were getting their media, where they lived, all this demographic data. And it was so fascinating to me. And I talked to my boss and I said, oh, what are we going to do with this great report and all this wonderful data? And she said, we're going to put it on that shelf with the other reports. And I, unfortunately, that feels like a moment that has come back to me over and over again in my history with NPR.
Okay, but meanwhile, since 2002, I believe, when the first iPod was introduced, of course, the very genesis of the word podcast, which was an asteroid moment for NPR. I mean, you might have joined at a time when they were still literally cutting tape, and there was a supremacy of the NPR member stations. Whoever had the tallest tower, you know, the hundreds of stations across the country would have the means of distribution. But of course, the smartphone changed all of that. I believe I listened to my first podcast on Slate. Does that sound right?
You may have. Slate was a pioneer in podcasting and way back at the start of the 21st century. And so it's quite possible that your first podcast experience was Culture Gabfest or Political Gabfest.
And I remember the novelty of being able to fast forward and rewind. And actually, if you took the time to drag this onto iTunes, you could carry it around on your iPod Touch. And how cool was that?
I remember the subway. Those.
I was still playing around with the janky cassette adapter for cars, but we didn't realize how how bougie it would feel to have seamless Bluetooth by the year, 2015?
Yes, those were, I mean, those devices that now seem antique were very, very, made you feel very sort of tech forward back in the day.
They call them Jurassic parts, by the way, but that's neither here nor there. Meanwhile, I'm fast forwarding to the year 2024. After NPR and audio and journalism has just a I would say a depression type year in 2023, Slate reports its best year on record. Now, Slate has been around for 27 years, and I believe it was originally owned by Microsoft. I would hear about it. You know, it was this Bill Gates hobby horse in the mid-90s, but amid a difficult year for news media last year, I'm reporting Semaphore. Kate Rayford, your spokesperson, told Semaphore that 23 was the most profitable year in the digital company's 27-year history. Revenue grew 28% year over year through a series of investments and growth in its core business, which revolve around its podcasts and website. And here you are as the head of audio in a year when advertisers were pulling away left and right, where I believe NPR had 10% staff layoffs. Was that this year, last year?
I think it was late last year.
And you guys went on an acquisition binge. Did you buy Death, Sex, and Money?
Yeah, I don't know if I would classify that as an acquisition binge, but we're very proud to be the new home of Death, Sex, and Money.
So let me understand this. If you have an example here where it's booming and it's certainly working for players such as Vox Media and others to a certain extent, they've been culling some podcasts. What is structurally preventing the old mothership NPR from being able to feel these kinds of oats?
You know, one of the sort of structural cultural challenges at NPR is change of any kind. You know, in order for that organization to, you know, shift tactics or even have sort of a serious examination of practices that are or are not working, first, you have to get a lot of different ducks in a row. You've got hundreds of member stations that you need to get on board, and then you need somebody in NPR leadership to admit a mistake. I mean, and that's a real problem and has been for a long time, which is that, you know, one of the consequences of having some of the smartest people around in an organization is sometimes telling those people that they're wrong involves sort of a degree of intellectual combat in order for them to even acknowledge the possibility that they've made a mistake. And if you're a person who's not sort of traditionally part of the power structure, if you are a person of color, if you are younger, if you're not sort of looped into some kind of elite socioeconomic group or university system, if you're not an Ivy League grad, you know, your opinion can get dismissed pretty easily, even if the evidence and the facts are on your side about, you know, whether the organization should be taking another look at a practice. And so I think that, you know, resistance to the idea that the organization has ever done something wrong is kind of at the heart of a lot of these business challenges and editorial challenges at NPR.
But Alicia, you could tell, I mean, as you've seen the bankruptcies in FM radio with what used to be Clear Channel and iHeartRadio. Structurally, that's just changed. We're not talking about compact discs. We're not talking about VHS. Everybody has an unlimited data plan. Cars come with this, as I said, seamless Bluetooth that makes you feel like a millionaire. You can multi-home on your phone. You could have Spotify, which has a wonderful user interface, or Apple Podcasts. You can get these in all sorts of places. The writing should be all over the wall that especially younger people are not pressing. And I'm going to get a little breathless here, especially in the pandemic and that we're driving less. We're not pressing that one button and waiting for the show to come on a terrestrial radio clock.
That's all true. But I mean, you're in public radio. And I think that these cultural elements are different member station to member station. But certainly you've witnessed the challenges of just turning that great big ship around. And also, I think one of the other problems with public radio in general is that this is a non-profit organization. And a lot of the time, the leadership has... in my experience, the leadership interpreted that in a way that meant the sort of the numbers of a particular project or a particular show, they weren't really paying a lot of attention to, okay, so this is going to cost this much to produce. It's going to, in this roundabout way, bring in this much in resources. The top line is supposed to be bigger than the bottom line, but it's not. And so this is a bet that we're not going to make, or this is a bet that we are going to make. A lot of the time, ideas were evaluated more by who brought them in. And if somebody were in favor in the organization, they could have the worst idea since New Coke, and it would still get greenlit. And somebody who was, I mean, I mentioned in the piece, Theo Balcom, who had this idea for a daily news podcast for a while. And I remember her, you know, going through that NPR process of having this meeting and that meeting and doing this PowerPoint presentation and answering all these, you know, the process for getting your idea, even if it's the best idea in the world, through that bureaucracy is just, it's been discouraging to a lot of people beyond me.
Theo Balcom, going to come in on M-dashes here. One of the more talented young editors I worked with, I believe it was on Weekend Edition Sunday. If we go back 15 years, Jeff Bennett and others used to work on story ideas with me. And fast forward into this period, you have the primacy at NPR of shows such as Morning Edition and All Things Considered, maybe in between Fresh Air and other things. And she comes in with this idea of a podcastable version of one of these magazine shows, and it gets stuck in analysis paralysis. But yeah, she and another person, I believe Kinsey Wilson, who was let go from this company, the head of digital, took this to the New York Times. Now the New York Times, which is a colossus of audio publishing, and it's gotten its groove back because of, you know, lifestyle brands, the subscription economy, the Trump bump. You are seeing member stations, NPR stations out there, go out and pick up the Daily. So she could not build that internally at the mothership. Explain that for me.
Well, you know, I think that running public radio, running NPR is complicated, and it's legitimately complicated, because having sort of independent content that's not piped through the member stations can feel like a threat to the member stations. You know, if people are just coming straight to NPR, the idea is, okay, so how does this fit in to a membership dynamic? If people stop thinking of their local station as the conduit to NPR content, then those stations, and some of them quite small, as you know, it's like not every member station is a WNYC or a WAMU.
Which have their own problems, as you know.
Which have their own problems. Oh, my goodness. Yes, indeed they do. But, you know, there is a legitimate challenge there. The problem with the way NPR can respond to sort of those legitimate challenges, or at least this is something that I observed, is punting. You know, there was an early podcasting program in the, you know, late aughts, you know, 2008, I think, or 2009. And it's like, whoa, podcasting's not going anywhere. Let's pump the brakes on this. And that was kind of a strategic error.
Well, this could be a mundane innovator's dilemma in defense, right? All sorts of companies. I can give you examples. McDonald's, as recently as 2006, owned 90% of Chipotle. It spun it off. Chipotle goes on to have a spectacular 15 years.
Yeah.
I think it's worth like half of McDonald's now. Microsoft never saw the smartphone coming the way it did. I think Bill Gates held the first iPod and said, it's curious, but why would anybody not on a Mac system ever want one of these, right? He completely failed to see it. We could discuss this with NVIDIA, with all sorts of people out there who are so stuck in their business model. And if you're a member station, and again, I love my member station, Radio IQ, they overwhelmingly depend on the pledge drive. This is how they've made money for time immemorial. And they repatriate money back to the mothership for important shows such as Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Fresh Air. They might get Here and Now from WBUR. They might get the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC. But you have to, from a self-preservation perspective, say that that is a diminishing, just like cord cutting on cable TV, that is diminishing. I mean, we might be able to ride this out for 5 or 6 years, but on an actuarial level, that revenue is just not going to be there in 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, but, you know, I know that I've been critical of NPR, and I'm going to continue to be critical of NPR because, you know, every good institution still needs people who are motivated to help it get better and you know, share some hard truths or challenging perspectives in order to make that happen. But there is an understandable argument to be sort of institutionally conservative. You're dealing with other people's money. You know, NPR is a nonprofit, and it's dependent on, you know, not government funding the way people who are critical of the organization like to pretend, but it is dealing with people's pledges. It's dealing with, you know, other organizations kind of giving to the institution because the institution is reliable and not given to sort of chasing the latest fad. And so that is a legitimate sort of weight against falling, not just falling into, you know, this or that fashionable business move of the moment, but also just being a lot more careful about where assets are going to go and require some higher level of proof. So it's not just that the organization is full of people who, at the leadership level especially, are arrogant about their own powers of understanding. It's also sort of built into the business model of the organization that it's not an entrepreneurial space. In a lot of ways, it just can't be.
Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad. We're talking to Alicia Montgomery. She is the head of audio at Slate, which had its best year ever in 2023. Mind you, this is very much Web 1.0 or Web 0.5. This Slate is more than a quarter century old, and it's really found its groove in audio. Maybe it's scaled back on events somewhat. You've seemed to have found the holy grail of curation for audio and which shows to promote and which shows to pounce on and profiting on these shows that is really popular. Let me ask you about podcasts. That is an opportunity. If I think about the architecture of a system, you can get, is there part of you that when you looked at podcasts, both when you were at NPR and when you were at Slate and even at a member station, part of you wants to say, if I'm a member station or if I'm an organization, I want to put these up behind some wall or a subscription thing where I am underwriting this and I want to collect the rents on it. NPR never quite did that. NPR has the NPR One app. It's now the NPR app. But I could get an NPR podcast on Spotify or on Apple, ditto with Slate. You know, you're agnostic as to where you offer them out there because it's ultimately a marketplace of ears and how many you get. But why wouldn't they have treated it like a Netflix or somewhere where you could only get this content behind an app? An app that charges people and charges people dearly. I'm thinking about the New York Times app.
I mean, this is going to sound very strange because I'm going to step up and defend NPR again, is that it's supposed to be a public service. And when you are, you know, not, again, just a couple of dimes or pennies in the pot from the government, but when you're relying on people's donations and people's donations on the premise that you're a public service, and then you're going to turn around and charge some kind of premium to get access to the content, it's very hard to make that philosophical argument.
But it's just channeling the donation generationally. And I'm not necessarily playing devil's advocate. Mm-hmm. How many of the contemporaries, 20 and 30-somethings, are going to listen to a pledge drive and send a check? Or do you know what I'm saying? Again, this is tough love for an organization that we both love and admire.
Yes, love.
And you say once a nipper, always a nipper, right? But who does pledge drives? We do live events and we give mm-hmm. the cards out, but 30-somethings, 40-somethings don't do that. They do go to Pod Save America type events. They do buy merch. They do you know, send money to certain Patreon accounts. And I just don't believe that NPR and its member stations speak that language. Am I wrong?
You know how varied member stations are. And I, you know, I can speak from my experience and what I'm told by the people who I know who work in this or that member station. But it wouldn't surprise me that if somewhere in the galaxy of hundreds of member stations around the country, you're not seeing some kind of creative fundraising and sort of creative ways of finding new audiences and getting those audiences to kind of participate in supporting programming. It's just, it's a challenging prospect. And I mean, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that at best, maybe 20%, maybe less, of the people who listen to NPR are contributors to their member stations, and that was back before podcasting ever happened. You know, it was always a minority of a minority of people who were supporting that content. And to say, okay, well, this force is out here in the marketplace, and we should capitalize on it. Well, you don't necessarily have people in public media who are experts on on making that kind of change and making that sort of pipeline for resources happen. And you talk about sort of some of the problems and challenges that are just part of the public radio model. That's one of them, is that if people are great at making money and that's their objective in the world, why are they hanging out in the C-suite at NPR?
There's a lot. I mean, look, dare I say it? It's essential, but it's not necessarily efficiently run. Maybe akin to Amtrak, right? The Northeast Corridor. I'm sorry, I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for that. The Northeast Corridor. There's no better way when it works to go between DC and New York and Boston, right? As opposed to dealing with the interstate and congestion and smog and the airports and TSA delays. It should work, but it's never funded correctly. Amtrak has to take care of all these unprofitable routes, and it's a very difficult thing to innovate through and to turn around, like you talk about that supertanker, but it's essential, and you want it to succeed.
Yes, I mean, we all want it to succeed. Well, I think that people in the public radio universe, even people who've been hurt in the public radio universe, part of the reason why they were there in the first place is because they believe in the mission, which is to, you know, help create a more informed, more thoughtful, more compassionate citizenry through journalism and through the practice of the sort of the best kinds of journalism. And sort of setting up NPR, and I think this was a big part of why Uri's piece angered me so much, is that it's a tough mission on a good day. And when, you know, all of the factors are in the organization's favor, but when people are out there, people who should know better, sort of inviting the least constructive of the organization's critics, just sort of giving them a narrative that bears little relationship to the truth, you know, it makes it a challenging mission even more difficult. And I do think that the mission of NPR, the mission of public radio, is something that the country should invest in. I just think that the people who are running the organization could do a better job of staying true to that mission and not sort of cutting corners and buying into some of this, I'm falling into some of these traps that are set in bad faith.
Full disclosure, please do stay with us. This show podcast to NPR, Spotify, all the fine podcatchers, including and especially Apple Podcasts. The link, which has all of them, is fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. And don't look now, but we are turning 10 this week. May 1st, 2014 was our very first show. I can't believe we're about to enter our awkward adolescence. Who knows what the heck it holds? Who knows how long I'll be doing this or whether I finally capitulate and open that Persian food truck? Regardless, you can follow all of our ramblings and musings on the socials at handle Full D Radio. Alas, my DMs are always open. If you're just joining us, it is my pleasure, my honor to have Alicia Montgomery, the head of audio at Slate. She's joining us from DC. We're talking about the existential issues of the audio business in 2024. Of course, Slate had a record year in 23. NPR had a pretty forgettable year. And indeed, you wrote this essay in Slate just the middle of April, the real story behind NPR's current problems. Yes, the broadcaster is a mess, but wokeness isn't the issue. I'd love to read a little clip And that's, if I could just read this. And that story is that NPR has been both a beacon of thoughtful, engaging, and fair journalism for decades and a rickety organizational S show for almost as long. If the former CEO, the big bad of this Yuri piece, failed to fix it or somehow made it worse, that's a failure he shared with almost every NPR leader before him. But if, as this editor Yuri charges, albeit in a negative way, the former CEO Lansing genuinely managed to break the network loose from the grasp of self-righteous white liberal identity politics, even in an imperfect way, that would surprise the hell out of me, especially given the well-reported exodus of top journalists of color and the loss of a diverse group of journalists during last year's podcast layoffs. Bingo. I mean, they lost. I mean, can we count the ways, whether out of weakness or competitors sensing blood in the water? They lost Lulu Garcia Navarro. They lost, yes, Sam Sanders. Noelle King, I miss her voice on Morning Edition. Was it Bracton Booker?
Bracton is at Politico.
They lost, Code Switch, you want to talk about Shirin Marisol Meraji, right?
Yes.
And I remember her story of how difficult it was to even get Code Switch accepted as a podcast. Meanwhile, it wins like Podcast of the Year several years ago, and they can't keep her. And then I'm thinking about you, Alicia Montgomery. You run the short tour of duty at WAMU, the NPR megastation in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. We'll get to it. And you get get called back up to NPR, but in the throes of the pandemic, late March 2020, Slate comes in and hires you away. Why can't this place hold on to talent of color, especially in that the outgoing CEO is called that their true north is appealing to a wider audience?
I mean, just to be the old school journalist, I was at NPR for the better part of 20 years. The people who you mentioned, you know, Lulu Garcia Navarro, Noelle King was in and out of NPR proper, but she had spent time at WNYC. You look at Sam Sanders, who started out, I think, as an intern or a fellow and then became,
right,
a host.
Yeah.
I don't remember where he had his internship, but he did do political coverage during the 2016 election. These people who spent a good 10 years, a good chunk of their careers at NPR, because there's so much to love about that place. But something that sort of continues to happen is you can just kind of run out of patience. There are only so many times you can see the organization make this what you hope is a good faith attempt to address some of its issues. But if you're there for long enough, there is a clear kind of pattern here. Somebody does something terrible or something dramatic happens in the outside world. Lots of ad hoc committees are pulled together. You know, people from across the newsroom and across the organization are encouraged to meet and problem solve and discuss stuff
fair enough.
Their findings with the leadership.
I'm sorry to interrupt you or to sound mansplaining, but you get
A
younger listenership, especially used to these voices in corners. Like Sam Sanders would riff on everything. I would talk, you know, he'd talk about, and it's been a minute, I think his auntie would come in or he'd talk about
Aunt Betty,
yes. And he'd talk about, there was one episode that I think his passion for Cyndi Lauper. I got used to these people, both terrestrially and on pod, and you yank them away. And it's a competitive environment. Of course, the New York Times and Vox, they're for-profit enterprises. They could pay more. They could might offer quite well a much better lifestyle than having to wake up at 3 a.m. and hook up your tagline and be on that clock and having to change notes and you know, it's a burnout culture, especially during the news cycle of the pandemic. But how can you not hold on to talent? It's still a talent-driven organization.
Well, you know what? I don't know what everybody's contract negotiations were like. I don't know in these individual cases. I think that the reports on people of color leaving sort of visible positions at NPR showed that there were a variety of reasons given. But you know, there's no delicate way to put this. If you find yourself in an organization as a person of color and you're doing fine, and you're doing, you know, you're able to have this experience where you feel supported in the organization and you're doing good work and you're getting good notice. But you look around and people who are part of your, you know, your community, whether that's the LGBTQ community, whether it's a community of color, whatever your group, seem to be sort of systematically kept in their place. After a while, you stop believing, or you stop believing that the organization is offering a fair opportunity to everybody. And maybe you start, and of course, now I'm projecting, but, you know, you start seeing yourself as that one black kid in the college catalog for the, you know, the liberal arts university. And you've been seeing yourself as doing this important work and being supported in doing this important work. But it occurs to you that maybe you're being supported in doing this important work so that the organization doesn't have to answer for the dozens of other people who share your identity but have found lots of roadblocks in their professional paths. And maybe that's some of what happened to some of the high-profile folks of color within the public radio system. I know that that happened to me.
What happens behind the scenes when a show like How I Built It, which I always intimately, or, you know, who is the guy, Hidden Brain, I've always associated these things intimately with NPR, for better or for worse, mm-hmm. but then you see more well-heeled third parties come in and distribute them. I guess, what is Wondery, Amazon, or is one, I don't understand how that works, that NPR could seed fund something and then lose it. I mean, you discussed how it completely whiffed on This American Life.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, from the old days. Well, you know, one of the things, and I think that this is true across the board, and this isn't just sort of a journalist of color experience or any kind of minority experience at NPR, is that even the smallest changes, innovations, they get not lawyered to death, but kind of PowerPointed to death, what you call analysis paralysis. You have to go through so many layers of bureaucracy to get sign-off on, like, teeny tiny changes. There was this debate that I remember at NPR years ago about when member station reporters signed off. It's like, for NPR, this is John Doe instead of John Doe, NPR News, Washington. That was a debate. Whether we were, you know, whether the change in where we put a comma in a reporter's sign-off signaled something to listeners, or was this just something that was internally meaningful but did not really translate to the outside world? And if you think about that as an example, if you want to do anything different, then you are up against sort of layers and layers of conversations, of emails, of apologizing for not CCing, you know, this person but not that person on the email. It's just, it can be very daunting if what you want to do is innovate. And it could be, and I don't have intimate knowledge of about how those podcasts in particular left NPR, but that frustrated the heck out of all sorts of people in the organization.
Talk to me about your your brief, the cul-de-sac that you took to WAMU. I'm fascinated by it because I was so excited when you were there. I loved, and let me you know, break the wall a little bit mm-hmm. with this. You were one of the only people at NPR, both you know, when you were working on the tentpole shows and Tell Me More, which I fondly miss from a decade ago, who mm-hmm. would gladly take a meeting with me in the cafeteria, hold my hand as a creative, who asked me what I was following, what was in the news, what sounded great, what you should be listening to, who connected with me as a fellow parent, yeah. right? I was like, 360 degrees of Alicia Montgomery. What a catch. And then I was like, okay, this place can really use her. WAMU had the troubles and had yes. a bit of a mutiny and a social media falling out with its former director. And we're seeing that repeat all over again. It's a little bit like Camp Crystal Lake in the Friday the 13th movies. People go, there's new management. But again, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this. It should be so happy. It should be hitting its stride. It's one of the rare stations that's just number one outright in its market. And yet?
And yet. again, WAMU is the member station that I grew up listening to, you know, from seventh grade well into to motherhood. You know, I was an NPR listener through WAMU. Going to that station in a lot of ways was sort of the fulfillment of my dream in public radio, which was I was not just going to have influence on, and, you know, my influence at NPR before I went to WAMU. I wasn't in sort of the top tier. I mean, I did get to leadership as far as being the team leader at Code Switch, but I was going to be able to sort of directly impact the coverage for people in my community, in my family, in the place that I grew up, in the place that, you know, where I made my home as an adult, the communities where my family was. And that was incredibly meaningful to me. And in a lot of ways, I just loved that job. I mean, I was getting, you know, this mission that public broadcasting is supposed to fulfill, where I felt like I was introducing one set of people in the community to another set of people in the community and helping foster connections and understanding between...
And if I can interrupt, yeah. To have a Ghanaian or Iranian cabbie just give you a soliloquy about WAMU, they toggle between Kojo Namdi and back when he was alive, Rush Limbaugh. It was just very, very unique. You don't see that at WLRN. You don't see that in SoCal. It was very unique to D.C.
Yeah, I mean, and D.C. is such an interesting place because you have this really, you know, the power structure of D.C. is this transigent, largely white, highly educated, highly compensated group of folks that sort of switches out every 2 to 4 years, depending on the administration. And then you have this working class, black and brown, small city. You know, and I lived in between those two communities. I'm fifth generation Washingtonian and also a person who was, you know, working at NPR and in sort of the space where official Washington is. And I feel like public broadcasting has this unique opportunity to speak to different communities within the listening public and to help the people who were on Capitol Hill understand the people who lived in some of the older, you know, majority black communities and vice versa. And I loved that. I love the community councils where we talk to, you know, community activists, grassroots community activists who were working on, you know, maternal mortality in the black community or, you know, hunger or housing issues. And we also spoke with these people who were captains of industry or who were highly placed in the government who, you know, lived in the more expensive neighborhoods and just helping them understand each other and what they had in common. It just felt, it felt wonderful as a work experience. But then dealing with the leadership at the station was a lot different than that wonderful part of the experience of being sort of an ambassador in the community.
What is the struggle? We've seen it across so many member stations, and a bit of a civil war or mutiny, a cultural thing where you don't understand me. In the case now, in the second set of troubles with WAMU, they let go of a bunch of people at DCS, which was a website that they bought, and they said that we want to focus on audio storytelling when a lot of these writers who were digital dabbled in both.
Yeah.
What is this through line? You see it at WNYC. You've seen it at every station that has had, I mean, my hometown, Miami, WLRN has had it. There have been problems everywhere. Is it that we're a precocious newsroom bunch that we like to talk, we like to complain? It's a bit like a, you know, kibbutz or a communist parliament. What makes these places so volatile?
Well, because you've got a mission that is supposed to bring everybody together. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of the people who are producing content, the journalists, are coming to the organization to do a lot of what I just talked about, which is to go places and report stories that wouldn't be reported in commercial media, is to build understanding and cover issues in a way that sort of fosters a deeper understanding and offers more context. And then you have the people at the top of the organization who really love to be in cocktail parties with important people in the community and really love sort of the power that comes with.
Well, I felt it.
Yeah, yeah. The power that comes, cultural power that can come with a highly placed job at an NPR station. And it gets you into conversations with mayors and with business leaders and with, you know, high-level people in the nonprofit world and in other places in journalism. And that's more important to a lot of the people in leadership than sort of the making sure that people, my neighbors, understand what's happening on the school board. And that tension plays out a lot in public media. It certainly did at WAMU. And the other thing is that when you are driven by sort of that community service part of the public journalism, a lot of the shenanigans in leadership, the sort of looking the other way about abuses, whether it's, you know, racial bias or sexism or just mismanagement of funds, that kind of looking away isn't something that you get into public service journalism to do. And so when the bosses in these public radio institutions expect everybody to be quiet when they're paying off another harassment victim or, you know, silencing some other legitimate form of dissent, that's just not what you're going to get from people who come into journalism as a public service.
Full disclosure, stay with us. Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad. Again, we are talking to Alicia Montgomery. She is the VP of audio for Slate. She's had the job for a little more over 4 years. She was hired in the teeth of the pandemic, which I think was such a feat. When I saw that headline, my gosh, like who gets poached when unemployment rate is shooting overnight to 15%? I think it's a testament to how opportunistic someone was. And to that end, I want to discuss Graham Holdings, right? This is the stub of the old Washington Post company. Washington Post, of course, was sold to Jeff Bezos, the billionaire founder of Amazon. It's been struggling lately, but this business still owns Slate, which we said had its best year ever in 2023, produces Foreign Policy magazine. There are some TV assets. There are some maybe information media. The Graham Holdings company was founded in 1877, is based in Arlington, Virginia. I see that an SVP, Mr. Jake Moss, went to business school with me. I have to get back in touch with him. That's pretty fascinating. It's flying under the radar. It's a $3 billion market cap. You guys do amazing journalism. You get to cross paths with, I mean, does Felix Salmon still podcast for Slate?
He sure does. Slate Money and Slate Money Talks.
And you're kind of, how does it work? Are you kind of left on your own to be a profit center or to invest? How easy or how much friction is there in innovating or risk taking?
Oh my goodness, there is so much less friction in innovating. It's one of the things that's great about Slate is that, you know, you can come up with an idea for a podcast, and I did a couple of times, and the journey from I have this great idea, why don't we do it, to something being on the air can be incredibly short, especially compared to what I was up against in public media. And I think that one of the things is it's not a simple story when somebody leaves public media, but that kind of tension over, you know, just challenging the way that we always do things, whoever the we is. But it's like, if I can make a case that, you know, if we do this differently, we might see a better outcome, then, you know, it gets listened to and we can move on that. I mean, the flip side of that is, of course, that if something doesn't work, then we have to be more responsive to the marketplace and make some changes. But just having the freedom to follow through on a good idea is priceless and something that is still really refreshing to come into work to do.
And it's a flat structure. I mean, how does it? I know we're getting into the weeds a bit, but I want to draw the contrast. I mean, if you see something out there, if you want to invest in a spinoff or if you see an orphaned podcast, you have the ability to invest in it and you have a dedicated ad sales force behind that, or you have biz dev people, you have those lining up sponsors for it. And this is a digital native. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're thinking about, you know, which member stations are going to pick these up.
Yeah. I mean, we've got an entrepreneurial spirit the organization is relatively flat. I mean, one of the things that's kind of, again, public radio culture is that it's very difficult to move up. And so there are a lot of sort of middle management spaces between the people who are sort of at the ground level and the people who are, you know, the most visible voices, the most prominent voices on air. And so that middle management team has to do something. And what they do a lot of is sort of gatekeep ideas. And at Slate, because of the relatively flat structure, there isn't that layer. You know, I'm talking directly with hosts, I'm talking directly with individual producers, and I'm also talking with the people on the business side and having very direct conversations about what's working and what's not and what adjustments we need to make. And, you know, I was at NPR for, like I've said, close to 20 years, and it was a slog to get to the spot in management where I was. And the fact of the matter is that at a place like Slate, if you seem to have some good ideas and you are dedicated to making them work in a way that makes sense for the business side, then people listen to you. And you don't need to get the blessing of 15 middle managers to have a conversation with somebody who can make things happen.
What do you think about the integrations performed at the New York Times? Again, we talk about the fateful story of Theo Balcom and the young producer who cried, not Wolf, but guys, you got to do this. You got to pod. There's not everybody that's going to be listening to radio. Took those skills to the New York Times, and it was not at all preordained that the New York Times would become a juggernaut in audio. But now it seems so logical that you have all of these reporters, you have backstories, you have Meredith Coppett and a lifestyle brand and everybody subscribing to it, and you could put quality stuff behind a paywall. They've had some hits, they've had some misses, but it's not that hard to build a podcast studio or to provide cardioid mics to your reporters even on the road.
Yeah.
They've done it. You know, David Remnick at The New Yorker's done it, to the extent that I don't know if it's co-conspiracy with WNYC, but that's kind of mandatory listening. And I think, Alicia, to the lay listener, it's all NPR. It's like they don't make a difference, or if, you know, Marketplace is PRI or PRX is doing this, or The New Yorker is doing this with a member station. They look at that voice as that aesthetic all as kind of NPR.
You know, this touches on something that I didn't get to in my piece, which is that part of the intransigence of the culture at NPR, part of that is sort of based in this idea that people with audio expertise and ambition, they didn't have any other place to go. I mean, for decades, you did your audio journalism and your audio storytelling at public media, or you just didn't do it. And I think that the organization, the system, was very slow to understand that part of the rise of podcasts wasn't just sort of more competition for listeners. It was also more competition for talent. So you could frustrate people for years and years and years, but then the most talented people or the most ambitious people in that system had options and had options to leave. And maybe, you know, when I started at NPR, definitely, but even, you know, 10 years ago, that wasn't the case to the same extent. And so just thinking about, okay, what happens if this bad decision or this neglect of this project or this group of journalists, what happens if they take their stuff and they go to Vox or they go to Slate or they go to Wondery? Still, you know, when I left, that still wasn't being factored in the way it should have been.
Yeah, and so if I listen to Lulu Garcia Navarro now, it's like she took, they call it in investing terms, portable alpha. You took those skills, you took those voices, you could even take the Neumann, whatever, 87 mic. You could take the complete aesthetic and a bunch of young producers who were permalancers and interns and frustrated people for the longest time and take them to the New York Times.
Yes. I mean, and just keep in mind, I mean, one of the things that, you know, NPR is in so many ways, is such a lovely place to work. It can be really wonderful. But I think that the organization was counting on it not just being sort of a wonderful landing spot for an audio journalist, but being, it still operated as if it were the only game in town. And if your ambition outstripped your desire for sort of the comfort of an institution with NPR standing, then an ambitious person is not necessarily going to feel fulfilled in that kind of environment in the same way that somebody who, you know, is content to do good work but keep their head down and not really, you know, challenge the system is going to feel settled there.
Alicia, while I still have you, the New York Times ran this big feature, as you know, this week, Inside the Crisis at NPR. Mm-hmm. It shows the bandaged NPR mic. Listeners are tuning out. Sponsorship revenue has dipped. A diversity push has generated internal turmoil. Can America's public radio network turn things around? Was by Benjamin Mullen and Jeremy Peters. What made you of that? That aired quite a bit of dirty laundry. Indeed, Eric Nuzum, who was an NPR executive, saying that they have maybe 5 to 7 years max to figure this out. And they don't even have another 2 years to debate the figuring out.
Yeah, you know, I know that there is sort of a storyline and a narrative about what NPR's troubles are. And a lot of that is about sort of the politics of wokeness, which is just a word that's been so abused to the point where it can mean whatever the person who's uttering it wants it to mean, and mean different things in different sentences. The challenge for NPR has always been how to answer to listeners, to member stations, and to what can be a very hostile federal government, and trying to figure out what the answers are that are going to keep everyone on the side of continuing to support the institution. And yeah, that's tougher and tougher. And a media environment where you have dozens of podcasts doing what NPR shows used to do all by themselves like a decade ago, that's also challenging to figure out. But I think that one of the things that I think the New York Times piece missed was how, oh gosh, this is hard to say, but there are sort of systemic abuses in that system. The things that I saw and heard in reaction to the Me Too crisis inside the organization still stick with me. And when I was at NPR, you know, kept me up at night. Why is this institution that is, you know, has founding mothers as opposed to founding fathers, why is it so indifferent to the abuse and exploitation, frankly, of a lot of brilliant young women? You know, why is the institution reacting in a way to sort of minimize the public scandal, but not the threat that, you know, young journalists are going to be exploited or harassed and doing very difficult work? You know, people are at NPR headquarters at 2 o'clock in the morning, at midnight, at 4 in the morning, just getting the news out to the stations and to Americans and actually out all over the world. And you would think that people would sort of place a premium on making sure that those folks were taken care of and could do this very hard job in a safe environment. But when I was there and I was witnessing sort of the fallout of Me Too and how it rippled across the organization, that just wasn't the case. And I wish that the people who, you know, considered themselves, I mean, this was something that really bothered me about Uri's piece and the reaction to it, where it's like, oh, he's really, really brave. And it's like, you know, I don't know the full extent of his career, but I was sort of a desk jockey at NPR, and I had colleagues who were literally dodging bullets in war zones. And so to call yourself or allow yourself to be called brave for, you know, stating a, you know, a contrary opinion under those circumstances, I mean, what the heck is that about? But I want people to focus on making sure that their public radio is being produced in an ethical manner. And an ethical manner means that leadership doesn't just kind of shrug its shoulders when it finds people in leadership actively abusing young journalists. It's not okay.
Really, at the intersection of culture and business model and innovator's dilemma, it's really an unenviable thing. And I forget how many CEOs NPR has had since what Vivian Schiller was pushed out in 2011. I don't know if this is standard for a place to have that kind of turnover. Maybe it speaks to how difficult the mandate is, and having, you know, the public constituencies and young restive journalists and board members who are more conservative with the member stations. But there's a lot to unpack there, and I'm so grateful that you finally came on the show, Alicia. You are one of the greats. Remember the name, Alicia Montgomery. She is the head of audio at Slate. You are more poachable than like Shohei Ohtani. You, as in terms of, you're like audio's Shohei Ohtani. Wow. I mean, this broadcast is probably going to annoy the people at Slate because it's going to get her poached yet again. But that's a testament to you and your passion and how long you've been kind of in this ecosystem as a lover of the ecosystem, but also a loving critic of the ecosystem. Yeah. So I'm grateful.
Slate's wonderful, by the way. So I'm not I'm not hunting for another home.
Come back on, all right?
I will.
Full disclosure, special thanks to Claire Morgan and Case Graham at Notterly. If you are listening to us on the radio, note that while we cut for broadcast length, the entirety of every interview is available on podcast. The link, please subscribe, is fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. Follow along on all the socials that handle Full D Radio, from LinkedIn, Twitter X, Instagram. I'll burn CDs of this episode and hand them out to you if you prefer. A shout out to our listeners on Radio IQ, Virginia's NPR News headquarters. Message me if you'd like to carry Full Disclosure on your air. My DMs are always open. And catch me every week on NPR's Here and Now. I'm Robin Farzad. Thank you for listening. Back with you next week.